Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am, as always, your host, Kim. Here is where we discuss the dark truth of true crime. You can reach me by email at amillionotherchoices@outlook.com. As an independent channel and podcast, I rely on program-generated ads to recover expenses. You can join me ad-free and without these silly introductions, and as well for bonus episodes on Patreon. Or if you want to buy a shirt or something, you can find merchandise at spreadshop.com or support the channel through one-time donations or super chats. Feel free to subscribe, follow, like or dislike, leave a raving or scathing review, and don't forget to tell a friend about me.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Welcome to A Million Other Choices. I am your host, Kim, and this is another case of a stupid and senseless murder. Today is the murder of Sarah Tokars.
And I know the answer to the question that everyone keeps asking. I know why you did this. You did this simply because you were not in a cage.
But was she dead on the day I arrived?
She was dead when you killed her.
I agree with the family. I hope you die in prison as well.
They disgust me that you are allowed to exist.
Sarah Tokars was born June 28, 1953 in Buffalo, New York to her parents, John and Phyllis Ambrusco. She came from a large family with six sisters, Therese, Gretchen, Mary, Joni, Karen, and Chrissy. Sarah's dad, John, was a surgeon who transitioned to professor at the University of Florida Medical School and then became the director at the Manatee County Public Health Department. He was also a lieutenant commander in the U.S. Navy who had served in World War II, so he was kind of a somebody and considered a pillar of the community. He actually passed away in 2002 at the age of 88. The majority of Sarah's childhood was spent in Buffalo, New York, where she was a cheerleader and maintained that level of enthusiasm and energy into her adulthood. She had moved with her family to Florida, where she started to work as an elementary school teacher. But one day, she had met a handsome man on the beach when she was visiting in Atlanta, whom she then married and then moved to Atlanta to be with him in 1981. He owned a health club there, and so she left teaching at a school to actually teach aerobics at his club, which was a rather exclusive club. There was a lot of the Atlanta Falcons that would go work out there. And Sarah started to make the transition then to like a nightclub promoter. But this first marriage dissolved, and then Sarah kept up her marketing and her promotion career. One night after her divorce, she saw a man on the evening news that she recognized from back home in Buffalo, who had gone to the same high school as she'd had, a young and go-getting junior prosecutor named Fred Tokars. So Sarah at this time was 31 and she was single and she was still as gorgeous as ever. So when she called him up just to kind of catch up and reminisce about the good old days in Buffalo, this phone call of theirs led to a small marriage ceremony some months later. A young and ambitious lawyer and a prosecutor of bad guys was quite the catch for her. Even though Fred wasn't exactly conventionally attractive, he had that kind of button-up accountant with glasses look. He was thin, kind of gangly look about him. But she had fallen head over heels in love with his sense of justice and his eagerness to learn new areas of the law. He had aspirations to one day become a tax accountant for the wealthy, because that is where the money is. much more so than prosecuting for the government. But still, his work was very important, and Sarah considered it so. Sarah, being a daughter to a Catholic doctor who had devoted himself to his family and the community, really wanted the same thing for herself. So a prosecuting attorney was kind of like perfect for her, sharing similar values and having come from the same place, essentially, and the same kind of upbringing. At this time, she was growing tired of the nightclub promotion life, and she wanted to settle down and raise a family of her own. So having children became something that she wanted more than anything in the world. And soon after the wedding to Fred, Sarah's dream of being a mother came to fruition, with the birth of their son, Ricky. Although Fred worked really long hours, he wasn't around much for the family dinners and the events, but Sarah was happy and she was a very doting mom. Fred bought them a nice house in Kings Cove, which was near the country club, and what could possibly go wrong? Sarah worked part-time after Ricky came along, but soon after that became a stay-at-home mom when she lost her job due to some downsizing. And she was fine with that. Being at home with Ricky was far more important to her than working outside. And so she really welcomed her new full-time role. And soon a second son, Mikey, joined the family. Around this time, Fred had decided to leave the district attorney's office to start his own law practice. You can't really be a freelance prosecutor. So he took on defense clients instead, switching kind of to the other side. It was a way for him to make quite a bit of money while he built up his tax clients, which is, of course, what he really wanted to be doing. Now, Sarah wasn't all that happy about this switch. She kind of preferred the prosecution side of things a little bit better, feeling that it was more noble work. But everyone is entitled to a defense, so she was fine with that. And a couple of days before Thanksgiving in 1992, now Thanksgiving that year fell on a Thursday, the 26th, Sarah and the two boys, Ricky, who was 6 at the time, and Mike, who was 4, left their home in Kings Cove for her parents, Phyllis and John's place in Bradenton, Florida. And on the way there, she made a pit stop at the Tampa airport to pick up Fred, who had flown in a little bit later. Now, on the Saturday, while they were visiting with her parents, around 1:30 in the morning, their security company from Atlanta phoned them to let them know that the fire alarm had gone off, but there had not been any kind of fire detected. Then around 7 in the morning, another false alarm had come in. And now this is kind of important. So Sarah answered the second call and told the alarm company to disconnect it while they were away for the weekend, since it seemed to be malfunctioning. After that second call, Fred had a flight for a business trip near Atlanta. So Sarah and the boys went to pick out a Christmas tree for her parents, and she told the boys that they would be back there again before Christmas to help their grandma and grandpa decorate the tree, which was something that the boys really loved to do. Well, the next day, so the Sunday, John took Sarah and the boys out for lunch, and they planned on sort of carrying on their way home again by car. They always traveled by car. So they left John at 12:45 p.m., and she said that she'd call her dad when they got in, which was expected to be about 9:30, 10 o'clock that night. Now, later, Fred called John and just sort of asked what time he thought that they would be home, and he had said the same thing, that around 9:30, 10, based on what time they had left. John tried calling a few times after they would have been expected home, but the phone was busy each time. Now, Sarah, Ricky, and Mike arrived back in Atlanta. They had pulled into the garage at home just a little after 10 that night, as they had expected to be. They had taken their Cocker Spaniel Jake along on this road trip with them. And by this time, Mike was asleep in the back of the car. So Sarah and Ricky and the dog Jake got out and headed inside with their bags and whatnot. And she figured, well, she'll come back out and carry Mike back up to bed. But she only made it to opening the door from the garage leading into the house when a man startled her by being in the doorway and pointing a gun at her. Now, Jake, being a dog started to bark at the man, and he kicked the dog to the side and then ordered Sarah and Ricky back into the car. The man got into the back seat beside the still sleeping Mike and was continuing to point the gun at the back of Sarah's head and then ordered her to drive. So Sarah begged him not to hurt her children, and the man said nothing to her but told her to take him to this housing project, but Sarah didn't know where that was or like how to get there. So after driving about a half a mile or so, he told her to turn right into this street that didn't have any lights on it that ended in a little bit of a dead end, like kind of like a cul-de-sac. Well, Sarah couldn't go any further down the road, so she kind of stopped on the side. Now, Mike had woken up at this point and was kind of tugging on this man's shirt sleeve in confusion, like, who are you and why are you here? And Sarah pleaded with him again to just let the kids go, do not hurt them. She offered him her purse, the car, like anything, just don't hurt her or the kids. Now, at that moment, the man fired the shotgun, hitting Sarah in the back of the head. Now, the car was still running, and this blast had sent Sarah slumping forward, causing the car to start rolling forward. So the man jumped out, leaving Sarah's car to continue to roll, which it rolled into this nearby field where it thankfully came to rest without striking anything.
Hey, hockey fans! Can't get enough hockey? Then get more with Team USA. When you crave the fast-paced, hard-hitting action on the ice, but you don't always love the big league price, then Team USA has you covered with all the thrills and all the energy at USA Hockey Arena in Plymouth, and all at a family-friendly price. Get more fun and more hockey when Team USA hosts exciting NCAA, international, and USHL opponents. Grab your tickets now at usahockeyntdp.com and see America's NHL stars of tomorrow.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.
Ricky had been splattered with his mother's blood from the blast, but he didn't actually realize that his mother was dead. I mean, he was only 6 years old at the time. But he knew to take the key out of the engine to make sure that the car was stopped completely. And he was like begging his mom to wake up. Well, realizing that she was not waking up, but like still believing at that time that his grandpa John could make her better because he was a doctor, got out of the car, grabbed his little brother, and then ran to a house that was nearby to get them to call his grandpa for them. Well, the man that answered the door to a pair of shocked and blood-covered children called 911 and reassured them that their grandpa would be there to get them as soon as possible. Police were able to get a hold of Fred at a hotel that was in Montgomery, who was completely distraught at the news, as were, of course, John and Phyllis, who were awoken by the police at their door in Bradenton not long after midnight. Now, back at Sarah and Fred's house, the police searched for some clues as to who could have abducted Sarah and the boys and why they would have done that. They found that the back sliding glass doors were shut, but the bar that secured the door, like a dowel that was used for security purposes, was laying on the carpet inside the house. They suspected that this was likely how the person had gotten into the house. They saw that the alarm had not been set, but whoever it was had not left behind like any fingerprints or any evidence that they had been there. Ricky, although only six, had this image of this man etched into his brain forever and was able to provide the police with a little bit of details that they used for a sketch. A thin-faced black man wearing a knit hat, or what we Canadians like to call a toque. Fred had gotten home on the next flight home from Montgomery, Alabama, where he had been, and sat with the police to go over anyone that he could think of that might have had it in for either his wife or him. Being that he was a criminal defense attorney, he had his own lawyer with him during the questioning, which looks odd for most of us, but probably not for a lawyer. Lawyers always have their own lawyers, so that wasn't seen as particularly weird. Also, being that he was not in town at the time, he had a pretty good alibi. And this alibi was pretty easy to actually verify because it was visiting a client in prison with like all kinds of cameras and check-ins and all that stuff. He had walked through the house with the investigators and told them that when they had left the house, that security bar was in place by the sliding glass doors and that the alarm had not been set because there was supposed to be a plumber that was coming in during the weekend while they were away, which is a slightly different version than John, seeing that he had overheard the phone call conversation with the alarm company asking them specifically to turn it off because it was having these false alarms. There was a safe in the downstairs office that Fred had. It was found open, and Fred said that he did usually keep money in there, but not much more than about $1,500, and that only Fred and Sarah had known the combination, but that the combination itself was kept in a file in the office. So someone might have taken the money, or it could be that Sarah had opened it and took it before she had left. Nothing else appeared to be missing from the house, but they really had nothing to go off of. They knew that Fred's work, both earlier as a prosecutor and now as a defense attorney, would bring him to the attention of some rather unfavorable types, but nothing really concrete of which they could say was a definite leap. The day after Sarah's murder, Sarah's sister Chrissy came to the police with this file that she wanted to show them that had been given to her by Sarah. Sarah had given Chrissy the file 3 years ago with instructions to bring it to the police if anything ever happened to her. Ominously, the file contained lists of Fred's bank accounts, of which there were many. Sarah, it turns out, had been trying to actually divorce Fred, but he told her that he would use his legal contacts and influence to make sure that he got full custody of Ricky and Mike, which was something that Sarah just could not have lived with. Sarah had felt trapped and knew that some kind of leverage against Fred was kind of her only hope of getting access to her children if she divorced him. She and Chrissy felt that what was in those files could be evidence of some illegal activities that Fred had been involved in. Now, financial crimes can be extremely complicated, especially with smart people like lawyers doing it. So the Atlanta police called in the FBI to help investigate if Chrissy's suspicions, which of course mirrored Sarah's, had been true. Meanwhile, the police took a little closer look at Fred and Sarah's marriage, which Fred had described as happy, supportive, and normal. When Fred had made the switch from prosecutor to defender, Sarah was less happy about that than she had let on. Not only was he no longer putting away bad guys, which was something that she respected and valued, but now there was the possibility of some undesirable types in their lives, because he was often defending like drug dealers, so he was paid in cash a lot of times, and that all just kind of brought an air of ickiness into their life, which she did not care for. There were also financial issues at that time. The house had needed some repairs, and they had two very young children, of course, and Sarah had stopped working outside of the house, which was creating a little bit more financial strain. Sarah had been put on a strict budget by Fred and was not allowed to have her own like bank account or even her own credit card. And he started telling her that they should only be dealing in cash, which was something that Sarah also found a little bit icky. And it didn't really make a lot of sense to Sarah. I mean, Fred was a lawyer, and don't lawyers make good money usually? It's not like they were living in a mansion. He was doing these tax seminars as well. He had a pretty good client list. But Fred would not discuss finances with Sarah and sort of left her in the dark about all of it. Fred had also grown a bit controlling in some other ways as well, like her spending time with her family. So whenever she wanted to go to Florida, he would either refuse to give her gas money or to like pay for any hotel rooms for them on the way. And Chrissy had also noticed that whenever there would be like a family trip to Florida, Fred always flew in. And then Sarah and the boys would drive this 9-hour drive from Atlanta to Bradenton. So Sarah had written her will after Mike was born, and she had left everything to the boys, naming her sister Therese as executor and also as trustee. Sarah didn't mention Fred in her will at all, just that her sister Karen would become legal guardian if her husband did not survive her, and referred to him as her husband, not as Fred. Fred had also taken out 3 life insurance policies on Sarah for a total of $1.75 million, with him, of course, as the sole beneficiary on all of them. But Sarah had grown convinced after Mike was born that Fred was having an affair or affairs due to the late hours that he was always working and how little time he actually spent at home. And it was around this time that the subject of divorce had first been broached by Sarah to Fred, and that he had made these threats to take the children from her. So feeling that she had really no option but to get some goods basically on Fred, she had hired a private detective. And she also broke Fred's rule of staying out of Fred's home office where the safe was. And that's when she had found the combination to it. And this private detective was able to confirm Sarah's suspicions about Fred having an affair. But by that point, Sarah didn't really see that as anything to really get upset over and was actually pretty happy to hear it. But more concerning to Sarah was what she had found in Fred's office in the safe. Sarah had invited a detective over to the house to show him what she had found. There were several bags of cash and these vials of what looked like prescription medications and lots of documents that she wasn't able to really interpret, but she felt strongly would detail some criminal activities. But the detective said that, like, he couldn't really take any of that because it was a violation of Fred's rights. And he told her instead to, like, make copies of all these documents and give them to someone that she could trust. She could also take the meds or these vials of pills to her family doctor. He would be able to tell her, like, what they were. This was, of course, before you could just Google that shit. Now, the detective felt that she was being dramatic over this whole thing and was just kind of being like a scorned wife because of the affairs that he was having. But these documents that she had uncovered were downplayed by both the prosecution and the defense as to their importance into their investigation into Sarah's murder. But they did reveal that by March of 1990, Fred wasn't just representing drug dealers, he was in business with some men that were using legitimate businesses to cover up their drug dealings, like an investor in like money laundering schemes. Fred had been handling money for some entrepreneurs, let's say, guys who were making a lot of money very quickly and needed some coaching on how to turn that money into more legitimate enterprises, like nightclubs such as The Parrot, where Fred was named as a shareholder and a board member. By 1991, Fred wasn't on the board or involved with this Parrot Club anymore, but they found it interesting that his replacement was a guy named Julius Klein, who was a notorious drug dealer. But seeing that she couldn't get detectives interested in these documents at the time, she did what he had suggested. She made copies of them, gave them to Chrissy for safekeeping, just in case. And she slowly started to drop the issue of divorce, kind of resigning her to the fact that Fred would like find a way to take her children from her. And that, of course, was less acceptable to her than staying in a marriage where she had grown unhappy and unfulfilled. So she volunteered at the kids' school as a teacher's aide and took the boys when she could home to see her parents, where, of course, she did feel happy and fulfilled. and basically just kind of went on with her life. So after Chrissy had come in with this file, they decided to call in this FBI, who were able to tell right away that these bank statements did show that Fred had been setting up these offshore accounts. But whether or not this criminal activity had been connected in some way to Sarah's murder would take a little bit of time to kind of go through the names and these aliases on the statements to try to figure out. They also asked Fred about some of his clients, and he had said that, yes, he sometimes had some rather dangerous men and drug dealers as clients, and that perhaps one of them had killed Sarah as kind of like a way of sending a message to Fred about defending the wrong gang or something. Apparently, the city of Atlanta in the 1990s was split into segments with these different gangs dealing in certain areas with turf wars and the usual drug bullshit that happens. Well, a brother of one of the detectives in Cobb County that had worked out of a different district told him that there was this guy's name that had come up with an outstanding warrant. Now, Fred Toker's name had also come up as having defended him in some petty criminal stuff. And this guy named Eddie was currently a business owner of several businesses from like construction to mortgage companies. So this got them kind of looking at him because Fred hadn't mentioned him as one of his like drug dealing clients that might have been kind of bad news. And it turns out that Fred had lent this Eddie Lawrence $70,000, and the businesses that they had actually owned together were all in some kind of financial trouble. Eddie was also looking at some criminal charges for some fraudulent checks. That's what that outstanding warrant had been for. His phone records showed that there had been a number of calls between him and Fred on the day of Sarah's murder. But of course, Eddie said that he did not kill Sarah or have anything to do with her murder, and that these calls were just all business related, as in like these businesses that they legitimately owned together. So he was arrested on the warrant and then let out on bond. But this made some people nervous that he was being investigated and kind of being looked into. So a criminal associate of his who had turned informant tipped off the police that in the weeks and days before Sarah's murder, he had actually been shopping around for a hitman. And he had asked one of his employees if he would do it for him, but this employee had said no, but then offered up this guy that he knew named Curtis Rower, who's a drug addict that needed some money rather badly. So a search warrant and arrest was issued for Curtis, who was living in College Park. He was found hiding under his bed, cowering, crying, and sweating about being arrested. He said that Eddie Lawrence had offered him $5,000 to kill Sarah, but he had been too scared to go through with it. But he admitted that he had carjacked them. Curtis said that under Eddie's instructions, he had been waiting inside the house for at least an hour before Sarah and the boys returned home, and that Eddie had known where Sarah had been. He knew when to expect her home, he knew her husband was out of town, and he knew that this alarm was not set. Now, he was under the impression that Sarah was actually Eddie's ex-wife and that she was kind of in the way of a lot of money for him. He had gone through with this carjacking part of the plan, but not the murder. Now, when Sarah stopped the car and refused to go any further, he says that he had chickened out, but that this Eddie Lawrence had suddenly emerged, I don't know, from the bushes, something, and shot Sarah, and that they both had fled together in Eddie's car that he had parked nearby because he had been watching them through this whole ordeal. Now, they didn't really believe him and charged him with murder and charged Eddie with conspiracy to commit murder. The next day, Fred went to a hotel in Florida where he had been staying with the boys at Sarah's parents' place and locked himself in the room, put up the do not disturb sign, and took a bunch of pills. But he lived and he was found by the cleaning crew unconscious. Now, some reports say it was Sarah's dad that had come to the hotel looking for him, but I suspect that they didn't really know where he was to go and find him. But anyways, I cannot verify who found him, but he was found. And now he later said that he was despondent over the loss of his wife and being chased down by the media, and that this Curtis Rower guy was just some guy with mental problems, and that he had told the police whatever he thought they wanted to hear, because that is what the rumors were that was on TV. On New Year's Eve, Fred took to the TV to tell the media to leave him alone, which seems a little bit counterintuitive. He oddly said that his wife's murder had cost him his whole lifestyle, which is a really strange way of phrasing grief.
Please deny any involvement in my wife's murder. I became very depressed. I started to think of the lifestyle that I was losing, not only my wife, but my whole lifestyle.
I think, anyways. He then immediately closed his law practice and started selling off all of his assets. He put their house on the market, threw out anything that he couldn't pack, and moved to West Palm Beach with his mom and leaving the boys with their maternal grandparents, like Sarah's parents. Now, the FBI involved the IRS in this, trying to take down Fred, because they believed that he had been the one that had ordered this hit on his wife because of the fact that she had threatened to divorce him and expose his crimes, essentially, something that he just could not let happen. And after learning his sentencing options for conspiracy to commit murder, Eddie was finally ready to talk a little bit about his actual involvement. He said that Fred had approached him to kill Sarah because he couldn't let her have the house and the kids and all of that that he had worked so hard for. Eddie, of course, had said no, he was a drug dealer and a criminal, but he was not a murderer. And Fred had told him that he had it all planned out, that they should shoot her in the house with the kids there, that they would get over it, they were young, and that it needed to be done when Fred was out of town on business, so of course he would have an alibi. Eddie was to be paid $25,000 for the hit, but he admitted that he didn't have the guts to do it, so he had hired Curtis instead, giving him all of the instructions that Fred had given him and an offer of $5,000 of the $25,000 that he was going to get. Now, he likely did not mention to Curtis the $20,000 cut that he was keeping for himself, but he did admit to being Curtis's getaway driver, putting himself at the scene. So he was given a 12-year sentence for his part in this plan, and Curtis got life without parole. Now, as for Fred, he was arrested at his new house in Florida that he had bought and charged with racketeering, murder for hire, murder, and some other charges, and he pled not guilty.
And you would have been how old back then?
26, maybe.
Okay, and Mike would have been how old then?
4 or 5.
Okay. The morning that you left, Rick, to come back to Marietta, do you remember that?
Yes.
Okay. And before you left, had you packed the car up with your mom and Mike?
Yes.
Okay. And did you go anywhere at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
You a little nervous? Okay.
He got in the car.
What happened when you got to the door, Rick?
I think she opened it, or the bad guy opened it, and then he said, everybody get in the car.
Was he carrying anything at that time?
Yes.
And what was he carrying?
A gun.
Yeah, tell us what the gun looked like.
Well, it was like a pirate gun. It, like, goes up and, like, goes down a little bit. You know the thing that the bullet comes out of?
Yeah.
That's in right there, and it comes back, goes down a little bit, comes... And it curved down. He got back in the car. He said, drive. And my mom says, is it okay if I just drop you off here?
It wasn't meaningful.
Don't try to with me.
What did your mom say?
I'm not trying to with you.
What happened after your mom said that back to the bay?
He shot the gun.
And what did you do next?
I sort of seen if my mom was, like, still awake or if she was dead, and then I wake my father up.
your older brother?
Yeah. People remember things better sometimes near when it happens than they do a lot later. Do you think you remembered
better then or better now?
What do you mean?
Well, I'm getting kind of old. So when I try to remember stuff that happened when I was a kid, I have trouble doing.
Yeah, but you know like how you like first time you hit a home run? Like that? You like always remember that, don't you?
Yeah, it sticks out in my memory, Dad.
Yeah, and that's like what it was for my mom is.
But he was convicted. He was given 4 life sentences with no parole. Ricky and Mike were taken in by Phyllis and John. Ricky grew up to be an EMT, and Mike attended Columbia University as a journalism student. He eventually moved to California, where he struggled to make a living as a writer. He suffered from PTSD and depression over his mother's murder and his father's conviction. After graduating from college, he had done an internship at TBT. Now, he still remembered the vision of his mother's murder. Of course, waking up to a man with a sawed-off shotgun pointed at his mother's head. During his childhood, Fred often tried to call the boys from prison, but they never did speak with him. Now, Mike grew up to be an athletic and tall. He was 6'4", loved to read, play music, and unfortunately he passed away at the age of 31 on April 3rd, 2020 from a pulmonary embolism. He is remembered as a gentle and very friendly soul. Just over a month later, Fred Tokars, who had spent his days watching TV and reading the Wall Street Journal, had converted to Judaism, growing his hair out long with his beard as well, developed some kind of neurological disorder and was confined to a wheelchair about 15 years ago. He died of natural causes at the age of 67. Sarah's sister Joni said at the time, he should have died in the electric chair 28 years ago. The pain and suffering that he caused those little boys was and continues to be immeasurable. And that was the murder of Sarah Tokars. Thank you, as always, for joining me today, and I will be back again next week with another case of a stupid and senseless murder.
Love a good mystery that leaves you wanting more? Check out my podcast. Hi, I'm Kadra, the host of Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. I tell tales every single week that have left me perplexed. You'll hear true crime cases, mysterious disappearances, learn about cults, hear baffling sightings of cryptids, chilling paranormal encounters, and even dark and weird history. I release new episodes every Wednesday, and you can listen anywhere podcasts are available. I'm also on Patreon, and you can even watch me on YouTube. Perplexity, a Mystery Podcast. Stories that will leave you perplexed.
This isn't just a game, it's a once-in-a-generation event. The Harlem Globetrotters 100-year tour. Celebrate 100 years of high-flying dunks, 100 years of show-stopping moves, and 100 years of changing the game. Bring the whole family and be part of the legacy. This game is once in a century. Be there at Schottenstein Center on December 27th. Go to harlemglobetrotters.com for your tickets to the 100-year tour.